So today, the computer is changing our world. The way we do business, the way we travel, the way we communicate with each other.
Can a computer trick a human being into thinking that they're having a conversation with a fellow human being? That question goes all the way back to a 1950 experiment called The Imitation Game by Alan Turing, a British mathematician and computer pioneer, amongst many other things. 16 years later, a chatbot called Eliza appeared to pass that test. People were convinced they were talking to a human therapist when in fact it was Eliza generating the responses. However, the question remained, was this proof of computer intelligence, or did it simply show it's really easy to fool humans? Regardless of the perhaps somewhat philosophical answer to that question, it is fair to say that language plays a large role in the ongoing process of improving the communication between us mammals and AI. So, are you thinking what I'm thinking? Probably not, because I'm thinking about slide whistles. My name is Michiel, and you're listening to Computers Don't Bite, a podcast by the Leiden Institute of Advanced Computer Science. In this show, you will hear computer scientists at the forefront of their respective fields as they attempt to explain to me what on earth they're doing.
I'm Tessa Verhoef. I'm an assistant professor at the Leiden Institute of Advanced Computer Science, and I work on emergent communication and language and how it evolves in both humans and machines.
On the intersection of humans and machines, we find the robot. Tessa Verhoef is dedicated to improving the human likeness of these machines, for instance, in the way they speak to us. I was looking at your website, and it struck me that every time I see a picture of you, you're either hugging a robot, talking to a robot, playing with a robot. Why is that? And where does your fascination with robotics come from?
My first love ever in academia was actually with a robot. That's when I first
Tell
started...
Tell me about this romance.
Yeah. Actually, already before I started studying AI, I remember seeing a news article about this Mars rover, the robot that they sent to Mars. And I was so amazed by that. And that was actually the reason why I chose to study AI. So during that program in AI, I really kept this fascination with robots. We did some projects with different kinds of robots, and especially one robot I remember very well, falling in love with that robot actually. And this was a robot called Kismet, developed by MIT Media Lab. So this robot could express emotions and interact with people in a sort of effective way. And so that really made me want to study basically human-robot interaction and seeing, basically how that could be done in a natural way. But also by looking at all of that kind of research, I realized that, you know, there's a lot of things that we don't really understand well about how humans interact or where human language comes from or why do we have language and other animals don't. From that, I also really got interested in the field of language evolution.
Let's first try to understand how humans interact, and then we can make the leap towards how computers interact or how we interact with computers.
Yeah.
You sort of mentioned AI and robotics in like the same sort of domain region. So for you, is a robot like sort of the physical manifestation of what AI can be?
Not necessarily, because I don't think not every robot necessarily has AI in it. So there are also robots that are used in factories, for example, that are not necessarily intelligent, but so it's mostly those robots that exhibit some intelligence that I'm mostly interested in.
Yeah, that's what got you fascinated on communication, on language, and that's why you went to study languages.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So maybe briefly, before we get into like the whole AI thing and social AI thing, which is sort of your thing, like take us on a quick tour of what you learned during your language studies.
Yeah, so I got really interested in language evolution specifically, so how languages emerge, so how do you go from a situation where there is no way of communicating. There's no signaling system to a novel communication system emerging. And so I did a lot of experiments in which I would study artificial languages, actually. So with human participants who were
artificial
given,
languages?
Yeah, artificial languages. So languages that are not like any human language that we know right now. But they are really completely novel.
Languages from Star Trek or?
No, languages, for instance, well, I can give an example. So in one of the experiments I did, I asked people to learn a language in which they had to whistle the words with a slide whistle. For example, in this one experiment, I was really interested in combinatorial structure in language. So for instance, the sounds that we use for speech, they have a certain structure. So we have a certain, like a basic set of sounds that each language uses. And there are rules that basically decide which sounds can be put together in which order, for instance. So that kind of structure is very specific. Every language has that structure. And I wanted to see if I could create a setting in which basically that kind of structure could emerge, like it may have emerged in human language, but with whistles, for instance.
So you wanted to recreate the origin of a language mm-hmm. in an artificial setting and study that. So what did you find, for example?
Yeah, so I think from those kinds of experiments, there's two main insights that I think are also important now for the field of AI as well. So the first is the fact that languages tend to evolve to adapt to their what we call linguistic niche. And so niche is a word that we use in biology, for example, to refer to the kind of environment in which a species can flourish. So it's kind of like the environment in which something evolves. In terms of languages, so when languages evolve, their niche is actually, for instance, human brains and the structure of a conversation, because that's basically how languages change. It's when they are used and when they are learned by people. And this is something that you see very clearly in these experiments, because then these whistle languages, for example, they become easier to learn and they start to gain this kind of structure that we see in real human languages as well. This is in part because they adapt to what we find easy to learn. So you can imagine that if a language is transferred from one person to the next or transmitted from one generation of learners to a new generation of learners, that those kinds of structures or words that people cannot learn or cannot remember or that are not easy to use in conversation, those will disappear.
So you're sort of speaking about a language as if it's like an organism.
Yeah.
Which is kind of strange to me.
Yeah, so that is indeed, like, that analogy is made very often in that field.
Or maybe even like a virus.
yeah, you could see it that way. Yeah. Mm. Yeah, so it's and this is, I think, also kind of a crucial point for the field of AI or computational linguistics, that languages evolve all the time. It's not like a language is not a static thing. It's new words get invented all the time. It's a super dynamic mm-hmm. system. So it's very important to take that into account when you try to implement natural interaction between humans and machines, for example. So the experiments I just described, where people have to basically communicate from scratch in mm-hmm. some kind of way that they're not familiar with yet. Yeah, you can do that with computer agents too. So you can implement computer agents that have a simple type of brain, for example, so they can learn some signals and they can communicate with each other and exchange these signals. The same kinds of experiments you can also do with computers, basically.
Right.
And the individuals we call neural agents. So these are basically neural networks, small neural networks that interact with each other.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so you're trying to use what you know about the evolution of human language to help improve their communication.
Yeah.
So how does that work?
So one thing that we know from human language evolution is that languages adapt to the human brain, for example. So like I said, what we find easy to learn will stay in the language, and what we cannot learn or process will eventually disappear. So language is adapted to what we humans find easy to learn, to our cognitive biases, to our constraints on memory and all of these things. But these kinds of biases and constraints are very different for machines. So if you look at memory, for example, our memory is in a way more flawed than a computer's memory, because a computer can just give you back from its memory the exact same text that you put in, snapshot, and we don't have that ability. So there are these important differences that and these differences are also the reason that sometimes when we run these experiments with neural agents, we get very different results.
Because we have different brains, we have different minds and mm-hmm. memories than one another, and so we learn in a different way.
Yeah, so what I basically in my research propose is that we should perhaps some of these biases that humans have, we should perhaps endow these neural agents also with those same kind of biases. So that basically the language that they're trying to learn is in a way also adapted to them. And so in these neural agent simulations, we're trying to see, well, both find out like what these exact differences are and what effect that has on the language protocols that emerge in these simulations. And then also see like how can we make those simulations more realistic and more human-like. So if we add different kinds of biases, or if we put them in a more natural communicative setting, do we then actually see more human-like language systems emerge?
I'm very curious how that actually turns out. But before we get to there, I really have a question on the why of this also. Why do you want computers to be more human-like?
Yeah, so what I think is, like, even if we look back in the 60s, there were already people creating chatbots like Eliza, for example. And this is a very early chatbot that tried to come across as a psychotherapist. So it would ask questions that a psychotherapist would ask someone in a conversation. And that chatbot had a few simple rules, basically. People could have a conversation with it and already have the feeling that they were talking to a human, or it would take a while for them to figure out, oh, this is actually a computer. And that was a very simple system, of course. With that system, I remember when I was a student in artificial intelligence back then that we were exposed to this Eliza chatbot, and that you initially you have this feeling of, wow, this is amazing. Like, how can it be so smart that human-like that you can have that conversation? But then after that, you also quickly realize, okay, something is missing here. And once you realize that, it's also kind of disappointing. And for me, actually, ChatGPT hasn't changed that feeling that much, to be honest. So
you're still motivated to
get there. Yeah. Because actually, like, when you have a conversation with ChatGPT, of course it's a lot more complex, a lot more elaborate than those simple rules that they were using back then for Eliza. But still, it's really amazing what it can do. But you also quickly realize that there are certain components still missing that we know from the field of language evolution are really important, like symbol grounding. So the fact that what you are talking about has a real relation to the real world, and mm-hmm. That there's actual understanding of that real world. And that's something that you currently don't see yet in these these chatbots. Yeah.
And then you could say, and that's okay.
Sure, yeah.
But then you have a motivation to take it one step further.
Yeah, and I think that motivation for me comes in part from wanting to build machines that can interact with humans in a more natural way, but also the fact that I'm not only a computer scientist, but I'm also really a cognitive scientist. So I'm very interested also in how humans work. And by building machines that can interact in a human-like way, we can also really understand how it works in humans better. Because then to build something into a computer, you have to understand the component parts so mm-hmm. well that you really learn something about how the natural system works as well. And that's another really important motivation for me behind this work.
Do you own a vacuum bot?
I do, yes.
Yeah. A Roomba? Is it a Roomba?
Roomba, yeah.
Do you have conversations with it?
Not really, no. I mean, and unlike many others, I have not given it a name, but this is also one of those examples where you can see that people tend to anthropomorphize even very simple robots, because mm-hmm. I believe that most people actually name their Roomba, perhaps also talk to it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's not that strange. And like you said, apparently we don't need these robots even to speak a language in order for us to treat them as friends or, I don't know, family. What's the biggest threshold for you to sort of make this leap where, yeah, robots can actually speak to us as humans, even if it's not a Roomba, but maybe a little bit more advanced robot?
I think that's also related to one of those things that that really follow from a lot of experiments that have been done in the field of language evolution, where we see that meaning tends to be really grounded in interaction history. In a conversation, it's really important what someone said just before, you know, the next sentence happens and things like that. That's you know, there's this kind of situated flexibility in the way we communicate with each other that currently we don't see yet in these kinds of chatbots. And so with one of my PhD students, we're looking at experiments where we, for instance, do these old language evolution experiments, but we replace one of the participants with a machine. And there we can also really see that because of this difference, because if you just called that cup a blip, and now that might be a bit surprising to me because I've never really used that word in that context. But now I'm in a situation right after where I want to draw your attention to that cup. Yeah. So it's very likely that I will call it a blip because, you know, I know that that's the right word that you use. And that's what I mean with this kind of situated flexibility that humans have. And we see in these experiments that mechanism really is what builds that communication system.
And that's how challenging for computers.
Yeah, exactly. So this is how conventions emerge really in communication. And this is something that, I think machines are not adapted yet to this kind of dynamic aspect, this kind of adaptive dynamic aspect of language. So I think that's a huge challenge. Yeah.
But they will be?
I hope so. Yeah.
You hope so? You think so?
I think so. Yeah.
Thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, sorry. That's Frank, my Roomba. Thanks so much for listening, and be sure to catch the next episode of Computers Don't Bite, a podcast by the Leiden Institute of Advanced Computer Science.